Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire.
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel. We are energizing transporter beam. Now.
Hello, welcome everyone to Star Trek From the Holodeck. I am Michael Flores, your host and captain. And sitting at my tactical console today is David Sabol. You got a much needed promotion finally.
Yay!
Now, if you say anything stupid at all, you're going to get demoted again right to that little bitch chair.
So if
you don't know what chair that is, that's the ensign seat, of course.
I'm just going to hide my Guinan files over here real quick.
Your Guinan files? Like, is that the first thing you're going to do in the future? You're going to be like, well, let me see what happened to Guinan. Man, I remember 10 forward. She really had something.
Actually,
going
you bring
on.
Up a very interesting point, Mike, because technically she is immortal.
She's not immortal. Oh, because of the Nexus?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's getting in some serious Star Trek nerd territory, Dave, and we may turn off some Discovery listeners. Like, what are they talking about? The Nexus?
Well, it would be my paradise.
Jesus. All right. So today, you and I are here, Dave. If you don't shut up, it'll be just me. We're going to be discussing Star Trek Discovery, Episode 3 of Season 3, People of Earth. People of Earth. This episode was pretty stellar.
Yeah, it was actually another solid episode after the first two.
Yeah, the series once again falling into their theme for the season, which is hope. I'm hoping this is going to be that guiding, much needed guiding foundation. I love when TV shows use a singular theme to keep the entire show just together. In fact, Dave, I will say that I don't think season one or season two had an actual guiding theme.
No. Yeah, I have to agree with you. I don't think either season had a guiding theme, except for you can make the argument for season two, because the guiding theme could have been like the relationship of Spock and Burnham.
Family, possibly. Family. Brother and sister. Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. Familial theme, yeah.
But overall,
is like in your face.
In your face.
Like all the marketing has been about hope. You know, here comes hope. And I love it because it just, when you use a singular theme, because as you know, when you break down a TV show, first thing you do is you should have that theme and what this show is about. What's the season about?
Well, it's about them going into the future and fighting all the baddies, and warp drive is no longer a thing, and the Federation is gone.
That's not what the show's about. Those are plot points. So you have to have what the show's about. Well, it's about the galaxy losing faith and hope. And when the Discovery returns, hope is reunited.
Yes.
That's what the season is about.
That's what the season's about.
And when you know that, you then keep your entire show intact. And I feel it already 3 episodes in, and you feel a consistency that is keeping the series together. And I love it. And it's not just there. The idea of hope is not just there, you know, for reasons of subtext, but also to draw some parallels and convey a few thoughts and where Burnham is currently.
Yes.
In terms of character development, a year has passed and she's grown. She's changed. And we will spend a lot of time on this aspect in a minute here after our first break. But I will say that I love everything that they are doing with Burnham so far this season.
Oh, absolutely. The absolute point where basically my whole feelings about Burnham, about like watching her the first two seasons, changed last episode when you see Burnham's face.
Yeah.
On the view screen for the Discovery crew. I mean, in our last episode, I said I got actually giddy seeing Burnham. Yeah. And it carries on even into this one when I actually like I actually got a little emotional watching her get reunited with her crew and her discussion or her talk with Saru in the very beginning about, you know, the whole captain thing. Thank God we finally get an answer to that one.
I know. And I do agree with that as well. Like, that is part of the thing that. Okay, so for example, can you imagine last season Burnham or a year ago Burnham willingly giving up the captaincy?
No.
That alone is a nice little clue there. They're called narrative plants. You're planting something there so that it will make sense later. They're trying to show you that she is growing. That she has matured over this past year and she sees things a little differently. I mean, even Tilly voiced the thought that Burnham seems lighter, I believe was the word.
Yes.
And she absolutely does.
And she does. And it goes well with that theme that you mentioned about hope. Burnham has to be our hope this season. And in three episodes, she is proving to be the hope of the season.
She is. I feel at the same time she's lost a little faith because, and we'll get into that later in the episode discussion. I think everyone feels a little like they lost a little something, some faith, just because they sacrificed everything to save the galaxy, to save all organic life, and to return to a time that, or go to a time where everything they know and fought
is
for
gone.
Is gone. I mean, that's going to take a toll, and I feel like that's going to be a big part of the season for many of our characters. It's going to be them having to work through these types of issues, and also at the same time, they're going to have to find their true sense of hope as well. And we found that towards the end of the episode with the whole entire the Federation, that the fact that the Federation, which for me was one of the greatest moments of the season or of this episode, was that Starfleet and the Federation ideals still matter.
Yes.
And the power of empathy and diplomacy still reigns supreme.
That caught me off guard. I was actually, when they got to that in the episode, and I was for sure that it was going to kind of go the way that, I hate to say it, like season one of Discovery would have gone, where we have this grandiose fight scene, you know, they essentially the winner of the fight proves that they're right kind of method.
So this isn't a sci-fi opera. This isn't a sci-fi opera necessarily. And Star Trek's never been that. We don't want the space battle. Sure, when the story dictates a climactic scene of action and, you know, adventure, then absolutely give it to us. Star Trek's always done that well, without a doubt. But when it comes, you know, to the nuances of the storytelling process, you have to always show that empathy and diplomacy is at the forefront of every decision. I mean, when Saru was like, no, we do not fire first. I mean, they're being threatened. Their lives are at risk. And Captain Saru, I love saying that, by the way. Captain Saru would not give in. We do not fire first. I love that they drove home that point. Drive home? That's not even proper English.
Drove
home their point. I thought it was great. I thought it was a moment that showed that the new, as some of the trolls call it, new Trek writers do care about the legacy.
Yeah. And like that moment too, not only did it actually mean a lot for the legacy, but I have to say, Saru as captain finally being in that role, embracing that role.
How are we not getting news on this? Like, listen, I get it. Having a non-binary actor is amazing and it's quite an achievement, right, for the queer community. But come on, this is the first alien captain. Where's the excitement? Where's the news articles?
Exactly.
The first alien captain. This is awesome.
This is how you actually do subtle storytelling. Like, I'm sure that a lot of writers out there, especially, you know, like Picard, would like to do. But this is how you do it. You bring a character who is completely different that all of us can relate to.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Now, we also got a new character. That's a Trill. And I so love this particular species. We have done Patreon discussions in detail about certain things pertaining to Trills.
Yes.
We've long said that it is a species that has always been expertly utilized to explore progressive thoughts on sexuality, sexual identifiers, gender, sociology, and how it pertains to gender, and dozens of other elements, seen specifically in one of the greatest treks of all time, Deep Space Nine.
Yes.
And I gotta say, I'm really digging how they managed to find the use for the spore drive as well. It makes Discovery an important asset and brings necessity to this new setting, and once again, a tangible hope that they have a ship that can actually do something.
Do something.
And I love that they brought back the spore drive and made it relevant and important to the episode, because that's something that you and I had said since season one. How are you going to get away with this spore drive? Not in Star Trek canon. And if it was such a success, wouldn't everyone else be using it as well? So they've once again removed it from the timeline. Of course, we know that. But yes, now we see it being utilized in the future. And who knows? It may be the new way they travel.
And I absolutely kick myself for not thinking about this from day one, because the whole question was, how is the ship of Discovery going to move around without using warp? And I completely forgot about the spore drive.
Yeah, so did I.
Because I'm like going, I didn't think, do you realize because that this type of... Because
it was more of a gimmick in season one. In season two,
it was used as a gimmick.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, when you see something like that, you never, ever see a series bring back a concept like that. And then all of a sudden, that's why this episode, I was like you. I was really happy that the Discovery writers basically looked at this and say, hey, no, we have this concept that we introduced back in season one.
Let's make it work. Absolutely. Leave nothing unused.
Unused.
Yeah. All right. So get more Star Trek from the holodeck every month by subscribing to our Patreon page. There are two specific tiers that holodeck listeners would love. The $3 tier, which is the behind the scenes discussions, bonus shows, pre-shows, and also the $5 tier. Our podcast tier gives you everything from the $3 tier, but also additional 2 full podcasts a month. So if you want to help us stay on the air, please head over to patreon.com/Rainman Digital and pledge. It's really the only way we can survive in this podcast-filled extravaganza of a world. I mean, this was 10 years ago, it'd be easier to cut through, but now we're dealing with big corporate podcasts with millions of dollars of marketing funds, and it's something we just can't compete with anymore. We used to be able to be just fine, but now you have celebrities doing podcasts and corporate sponsored podcast. So please help us out. Patreon.com/Rainman Digital and pledge. All right. So let's get into this episode officially. Dave, are you ready?
Ready.
The director of this episode, Jonathan Frakes, and written by Bo-Yeon Kim and Erica Leopold, the two writers that are actually going to be the showrunners of the Section 31 series. And yet again, Dave, they do not disappoint. We have been big fans of their work for quite some time now. I believe since season one, we've enjoyed their episodes the most. And you combined their writing prowess with Jonathan Frakes, and we're given a pretty fucking fantastic episode.
Oh, it's because of that creative team, the episode feels like, I honestly think this might be the strongest out of the first three episodes.
Yeah, I would agree. Even the other critics seem to be agreeing as well. A lot of sites are rating this one quite a bit higher than the previous two. Not to say the previous two weren't great, but this one definitely does stand on top. The synopsis: finally reunited, Burnham and the USS Discovery crew journey to Earth, eager to learn what happened to the Federation in their absence. All right, Dave, so let's talk about Burnham. Number one, giving her this year, okay, this writing gimmick.
It is a gimmick, yes. Oh,
absolutely a gimmick. But giving her this year has allowed the writers to rework her characterization a bit. From season one through season two, everything has been moving fairly quickly.
Yes.
And the Burnham we know is the character that's essentially on the edge of her seat. A bit of anxiety permeates, along with grief, loss, and possibly disappointment in herself for the decisions she's made. The echoes of the Klingon War so close and nearby, possibly blaming herself for the death of her mentor, Georgiou. And when I say rework, I mean recontextualize a bit. She's had a year to reflect on everything that has transpired.
Yes.
And just like Saru said, her perspective has shifted. You know, by having to let go of the ones she cares about, and even to a degree, some of the things she believes in, she's grown to accept certain things. And all those high standards, this is something that really grabbed me. All those high standards from her Vulcan upbringing, and perhaps the lofty eyes of so many with certain expectations, she's learned to enjoy life without the weight of expectations.
Weight of expectations, yes. And that's the thing that I took away from this was, like, at first I was like going, they're doing that gimmick of giving her just, we'll just say she had a year by herself.
Dave, I was a little concerned when they did that at first.
I was a little bit concerned because that is a writing trope that you could.
Sequest did it, and we know how that happened. How that worked out.
Wow, a Sequest reference.
I don't know why that popped into my mind, but am I wrong though?
No, like, you're not. Dude, it's usually not.
When you skip years,
that's jumping the shark.
It's jumping the shark typically, and I got scared.
But like the only thing that was kind of off to me, but it was kind of like, I mentioned to this to you going in because I was finalizing my thoughts on Discovery. My main concern was suddenly the relationship between her and Book was like, suddenly they're like, I got the feeling that basically they were a couple. Like, so in a year, Burnham's got that close to Book. And you brought up a good point. I mean, Burnham's by herself. She doesn't have anybody. Mm-hmm. The first person that she basically runs into, and I never thought about it, is Book. That's the only person that she knows in this timeline.
Right. So what's your point then? I'm confused.
My point was that at first, mm-hmm. I thought it felt a little forced, saying that a year's passed and suddenly her and Book are kind of like this couple.
So you didn't like the relationship aspect
at first because it didn't feel right, because it leads into that whole, I'm worried about them using that gimmick. Oh, a year's passed. Suddenly she's a totally different person.
But okay. How does the relationship factor in though? How does that bother you?
Because the thing about her and Book is like, we didn't see it grow that way.
You were afraid that we were going to skip a year of relationship building, and then suddenly they use this relationship as a way to
just basically put them together
and cheat writing and
suddenly
jump across massive potential plot holes.
Exactly.
And justify reasons why we don't need to see things like that. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah. Because remember in Discovery season one,
they
did the same exact thing with her and Ash. When you think about it, the relationship between her and Ash came out of nowhere.
Yeah, I didn't have a problem with that. I mean, she fell for someone who she felt like was an outsider like her. She didn't have a lot of friends because of the way people looked at her because she was a mutineer. So I feel your issue with the relationship. I feel like it would have done both characters a disservice if you simply pair them up and turn them into an item. I think that's now the douche in me is all, hell yeah, Book is getting some of that Burnham booty. But the critic in me is like, no, please keep them separate for the time being.
Keep them separate.
I don't mind if they put that relationship on simmer like they did. Like, we can have allusions to the fact that they, in fact, care about each other. And there may be something non-platonic there, which I definitely picked up on that. There's definitely something there.
There's something there.
But the fact that they didn't seal the deal and become a couple, I think that's a great decision. I think that's a good call because, A, relationships sometimes on shows tend to be crutches for various reasons in terms of writing. And I just don't think it's needed. I rather see a character who has been single for the past year and she's had time to reflect on her losses. And that's why the gimmick of this year gap works because it wasn't about this relationship. She didn't replace her problems with a relationship. She didn't use a relationship as a band-aid.
Exactly.
No, she actually sat there, made a friend, and reflected on her life as a single woman. And because of that, this is why she was able to grow as a character and why she appears lighter to Tilly and why Saru has stated that her perspective has changed. this is a character that seems like she's a little more comfortable in her own skin. But at the same time, she has reflected on everything that they've done. She lost a little bit of hope, a little bit of faith, possibly even the ideals of the Federation. That's why she tells Saru, it's going to take me some time to get back, because she needs to find this person again. And a year is a long time, Dave. We've all gone through, we've all gone through major things in our lives where we look back and we hope that we grow. And when we do succeed to grow, we don't want to go back. We think about that year, like, man, that was me a year ago. And let's say you are thrown into a situation where you do need to go back. Well, how do you make the person you were and the person you are today, how do you make the two opposing forces work? And that's what we're going to see within the next couple episodes. You're going to see the better versions of Burnham, the mature Burnham, the things that she's learned. You're going to see her now utilize those aspects in the show. And listen, I'm ready for this. This is what we needed. She learned to enjoy life without the weight of expectations. And it's a great direction to take her character, because what did I say before season one started, Dave, if you remember? I said the Burnham from season one and season two isn't ready for the captain's chair.
Yes.
She needs to mature and reflect. You remember I said that?
Yep.
And sure enough, the writers, this is why I feel confident about this season, Dave. If I can say something and the writers then echo it in writing after I've said it, then I know that they're on the right wavelength with the audience.
Absolutely.
For the most part, because I feel like you and I represent the level-headed side of the Star Trek fandom.
We're not the crazy ones.
Yeah. I mean, we got the same Burnham for two seasons. The person who was dealing with grief, as I said, grief, anxiety, possibly guilt. We've seen that Burnham. Now let some time go by and let's see a different version of this character. We'll give this person some time to grow. And because they did, Dave, I think we're going to get some of the best Burnham moments this season, because this is a different character. This is a different person, Dave. She does appear to be very different. She emotes differently. Her body language is different. The way she talks is different. I think it's a good call.
Yes, it is a good call, because when you take a look at it now, not only is it affecting Burnham, but it's affecting everybody else around her. I mean, down to the point that basically not just Saru and Tilly, but even Georgiou. Georgiou seems a little put off by the fact that this new Burnham.
Do you think she's put off, or do you think she likes it?
It seems a bit put off, but it makes sense, because Georgiou is very controlling. You got to remember, she comes from the mirror universe. The whole point of her character is she's controlling and manipulative. She wants to control Burnham.
I don't think I agree with you, Dave. I think now your assessment of Georgiou from the mirror universe is spot on. She is manipulative and controlling, without a doubt. But I think her saving grace, and I think we got into this, we might have talked about it during our second season discussion, but her saving grace. Well, let me backtrack. When you have a character like this who is just a bad person, she is. She's a murderer. She was the fucking emperor of the Terran Empire.
I mean, don't forget.
She's as bad as they get. She's an awful person. But how do you bring a character like this into the fold? How do you, in terms of audience, how does the audience learn to accept? And I'm talking about writing tactics here, where you got to give them a saving grace. Well, what's her saving grace? Her love she has for Burnham. That's what we said last year.
Yes.
She obviously truly cares about Burnham. I mean, that much was said with Burnham's mother, who traveled across time and who witnessed this woman's care for her daughter. She said it to her, that you look at my daughter as if she's your own. So we know she looks at Burnham differently. So what I got, and I could be wrong, my interpretation can be completely wrong, and we'll find out next week.
Exactly.
But my interpretation of that whole scene was, it seemed like she was happy that Burnham came back differently, that there's something of growth to her, that she seems better off. She doesn't seem as weighed down. And it seemed like she liked that. in my own opinion. We haven't had any moments yet.
Yet.
But it did seem, between the two of them, I should say, but it did seem like she liked it, that she almost felt like Burnham was deserving of this time to herself, and she possibly likes the person that she sees.
And see, for me, I think it's because I'm still stuck on the fact that this is Giorgio. This is the Terran Emperor. This is the person that basically is ruthless. We can't forget that.
But she's left that behind, Dave. And we're not gonna forget that. Look at the last episode. She wanted to murder everybody.
Exactly.
But Dave, what keeps her in line? Burnham.
Yes. If
Burnham were to die tomorrow, she would completely fall back into her old ways. But because she cares for Burnham, and she cares that Burnham will cut her off, and Burnham would not care about her, She stays in line. That's the only reason why this character works.
Yes.
They come in twos, Dave. This time, when it comes to Burnham, can operate on her own. But Giorgio at this point needs Burnham. Now, we do need to see some growth for Giorgio eventually, because we do know that she's a lead of the Section 31 series. And that series will have nothing to do with Burnham. So we're going to have to see some significant growth. That should be
interesting.
Yeah. All right. So the search for the Federation continues. The discovery chased Admiral Tall's message to only find that the Federation had moved its headquarters from Earth years prior in order to protect Earth from any potential Federation enemies. And it would seem that Earth is doing okay under the control of the United Earth Defense Force. Now, I had some reservations initially.
Yep, so did I.
I was nervous. When I saw all those weapons above Earth and the shield, I'm like, oh, shit. Let's not turn this into like a Battlestar Galactica war series. Like, is this really the Earth?
Suddenly the Earth becomes isolationist. And it just didn't seem right.
Right. And they are essentially isolationists in order to protect themselves. But it isn't because of some xenophobic tendencies. It's not because Earth de-evolved. You know, humans didn't de-evolve. It's because we're in heightened scenarios here. We're dealing with a catastrophe that was universal, that rocked the galaxy at a very, you know, scientific level, that destroyed everything.
Now, here's the thing that I... Would it have made it easier if we have actually seen the burn?
I think eventually we might. But I don't know if I want to witness it. And I don't think we should have witnessed it before.
That's what I was wondering.
Either in the first episodes. I feel like having that mystery is important to this show.
Because like the thing was, is like, I thought about it and I had the same reservations as you. It's kind of like, so you mean to tell me that basically the Earth, the burn happens and suddenly the Earth falls into this disarray where they say, F everyone, we protect ourselves.
That would happen, Dave. If we were to lose the internet, if a EMP bomb, EMP, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Yes. If EMP bomb went off over United States right now and we lost power, plumbing, the internet, we would be disconnected from society, and society as we know it, civilization, would fall apart in minutes.
In minutes, because like people would revert to, I hate to say it, fear.
Right. But therein lies the statement and the positivity, or I should say the positive aspect that worked for this episode and this decision they made. Because Dave, society didn't revert. Civilization didn't fall back to the old ways prior to World War III, as we saw in Star Trek First Contact, right?
Yes.
It didn't. What they did was protect themselves in the only way they could in a universe that just faced a catastrophe. But the people of Earth continued to be at peace. The people of Earth continued to thrive and be an evolved civilization.
Yes.
And I will stand by what I said. I don't think we're going to get that at this point, because I think it was clear that the human civilization pressed on as evolved individuals.
Yes.
But if they had given us an Earth that was a war-torn dystopia and people were all killing each other and it was just an awful place, I would have called foul ball. I would have come here on the mic and said, no, fuck that. You just destroyed decades of Star Trek and the very core concept that Gene Roddenberry had set in stone from the very beginning. We as a human society, it's what Saru said. I believe it was Saru. No, it was Burnham. It's what Burnham said in the very first episode. The Federation and Starfleet are more than just ships. It's something in the human condition changed. We evolved.
Yes.
That's why the Federation came about. The Federation Starfleet was a byproduct of human change. The Federation and Starfleet don't really matter. It's about the human condition.
Condition.
And as long as that human condition didn't de-evolve, then eventually we'll get back to where we need to be under the United Federation planets and Starfleet.
Yeah.
And that's why I was okay with this decision. But I will tell you, as I was watching Dave, I was biting my nails. I was like, please don't fuck this up. Please do it right.
And it's messed up that basically we are basically so paranoid of that happening. I wish I could just sit back and basically say, okay, let's see where this goes. I don't want to be afraid of this, but I agree with you. At first, when I see it, it's just.
I think it's a normal feeling, Dave, especially in this climate where we get a lot of reboots and remakes that completely throw out the rule book
for
the franchise that
they're
working in. I mean, we've seen it done in Star Wars. We've seen it done in numerous other franchises, and we're just afraid that they'll do it in Star Trek. But so far, for the most part, they respect, despite what some of the trolls say, they do respect what came before. But listen, they got to do it differently. And many of the people that complain about certain elements of Discovery are echoed comments of what we saw during the run of Deep Space Nine, almost verbatim.
Yeah.
And Deep Space Nine now is revered and remembered as one of the best pieces of Star Trek ever given to us. So I think people need to calm down and not get so overly worked up and wait and see what they do.
Well, I think that's why that ending was so gratifying to me.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, yeah, there's no battles. There's no nothing. It came down to diplomacy and basically communication.
Right, Dave. And that's why it worked, because we almost immediately see a contrast. We see, in all its glory, why the Federation still matters. The way they highlighted the moment between the human confrontation and the alien pirates that end up being
humans
as well. The way they solved this problem, the way they highlighted this moment through just a brief ethical decision and diplomacy. Not only do we as an audience recognize the importance, but so does everyone else. The characters, they immediately see what the Federation brings to the table. And it was truly great to see Captain, I believe her name was Nadoy.
Yeah, Nadoy.
It was awesome to see Nadoy and how impressed she was by how the Federation handles itself by simply following a core set of principles. And that was an important moment. We needed to see her reaction when she was surprised how the Federation held their ground, how diplomacy, there was obvious surprise when she realized what they do works. And that was so important, because what did she say 10 minutes prior? Why do we need the Federation? We're doing just fine. And yet we see immediately that they're not doing just fine. And this is why you need the Federation.
Exactly.
We literally just solved a blood feud by simply being Federation and Starfleet. I mean, that if that isn't respect for Starfleet and Federation, I mean, when the trolls say it's not, I mean, how the fuck can you say that? They literally just proved why the Federation and Starfleet is important.
Is important.
And this will be an important narrative plant for later when the Federation returns, because it will. And they will need the assistance of Captain Nadoy to bring Earth back into the fold, because it's going to happen.
Yes.
And it's nice, as I mentioned, it's nice to see that humankind didn't de-evolve into madness and nihilism or war, because I was waiting for that.
I was waiting for it too.
And that was one thing I just don't know if I could have gotten over. The as I said, the evolution of the human species has always been such an important part of Trek. And even without the Federation, it's nice to see that as a whole, Earth still stands for something good.
Exactly. And, you know, this is actually the thing I wrote in here. This is actually a really cool, I don't know if you'd call it a contrast or a parallel mm-hmm. to the last episode where we got introduced to that one, the one character that basically was jaded towards the Federation.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And basically seeing that nihilism, but then all of a sudden over here, seeing the Federation win out and basically say, no, you know, we're going to figure this out diplomatically.
Yeah.
It's such a cool moment for the Discovery to show, just like what you said, that theme of hope.
Okay, so look how well Burnham, her plan worked. That plan worked so well, even though she didn't have a moment to clear it with Saru. But because of Federation ideals, he knew what Burnham was going to do.
Yeah.
That's why this is important. The entire episode was designed to showcase the importance of the Federation, even more than ever.
Mm-hmm.
More than ever, it's important.
And I liked the thing I liked about that right afterwards, the old Burnham
mm-hmm.
would never apologize. But yeah. in a change of character to right. show that yep. her character has changed, Burnham apologizes to Saru.
Because it wasn't about, oh, I know better than you do.
Exactly.
It was, I don't have a second to even let you know what I'm about to do. I'm hoping you can figure this out.
Yes.
It was a very Spock moment. You see these types of things happen with Spock and Kirk almost all the time. Spock and
Kirk, yeah.
Yeah. And the writers also ended the episode on a feeling of optimism and hope. Once again, staying true to the theme of the season and Star Trek as a whole. A Starfleet Academy and the headquarters in San Francisco, still there.
I was so happy that they didn't do like what you said, where everything's destroyed on Earth. I'm like, oh, thank God. Starfleet Academy's still around.
How awesome is that? See, they know what they're doing, Dave. I feel like if this was like, I'm not going to say it, but if this was a group of writers that didn't understand what they're doing, Starfleet would have been in tatters. It would have been destroyed. But yes. No, it was there. And I really, really liked this scene for many reasons. But to keep it simple, the big oak tree and what it represented. Oh,
that was awesome.
I mean, it was an allegory for the Federation Starfleet. No matter how much changed around it, it remains an immovable force.
An immovable force.
Dude, that was fucking awesome.
That was cool. That was actually, that hit me in the feels. Where basically the whole tree scene with the crew and everything. Because this series has to be about what the Federation represents. And show basically all Trekkies out there, this is what Gene Roddenberry's hope for a perfect world should be.
Yeah.
And to that whole scene, dude, basically just encapsulates what Gene Roddenberry's ideals are. They're steadfast. They will outlast all of us.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry. To me, it was even more gratifying because it just felt like a big middle finger to the series that we will not speak of. Because in that series, the Federation is in crumbles. You can't trust anybody. You know, the Federation's bad.
And you don't even know why.
And you don't even know why. But here it's kind of like,
a Romulan agent become an admiral or a head of fucking security.
Shh, let's not go.
Yeah,
let's not go down there.
That's a disaster, Dave. But it's okay. Like,
that moment for me felt, and I actually wrote it here on my notes, it's a big middle finger to Shaibon. Basically saying, you don't understand what Federation is.
It's not even, dude. Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. But also I feel like if you're a competent writer, like these two ladies here, there's no way they watched Picard and were like, oh, this is so great. The entire show is just written poorly. So.
This is great. Yeah. It's fantastic. And they're like not shaking their heads at the same time.
Yeah. And you mentioned the crew, Dave. Once again, highlighting the bridge crew.
Yep.
They are aware of some of the mistakes, Dave. They are. The fact that they're making obvious changes they know that there were some mistakes made. And now they're trying to rectify some of that.
Yes.
That moment with the crew was great. But I got to say, like, who the fuck is this blonde girl? Where does she come from? Literally, she's in every scene now with the bridge crew. I'm like, who are you?
And I know, I'm like you're going to play an important role, aren't you? Because you've been in every fucking scene.
I had to look her up. Her name is Sarah Mitch. That's her acting name. Uh-huh. And her character name is Lieutenant Nilsson. And the reason why I looked her up was because I'm like, why are you in every scene now with the bridge crew? I mean, even though we didn't know much about Bryce and Rice, like we at least saw them from day one in the yes. background every now and again. But I don't think we've ever seen Lieutenant Nilsson. No. And sure enough, okay, so this is who she is. She actually has been a part of the show since day one.
Are you serious?
But she played Irium. The actor played Irium. And then when Irium died, they brought her back as Lieutenant Nilsson.
That can't be just like a simple. Well,
I think they like the actor and they're like, hey, I think that's it's as simple as that, Dave. I don't think there's any story reasons for it. I think it's like, hey, you know what? Irium died. Now let's bring in a new character. But she's been on Star Trek Discovery as Lieutenant Nilsson since the very first episode of last season.
Really? And she was playing Irium at the same time?
Apparently, yeah. Interesting, huh. Right?
That's very interesting. And I'm sorry. I will be honest. My tinfoil hat is actually starting to form because of that.
You have a conspiracy theory? You think she's going to transform to Irium?
I'm waiting.
I hope that's not true, Dave. I hope you're wrong.
This is where, you know, we get the control. The one villain from season two to return.
Now, one thing, then we need to go to a quick break. Nothing additionally added to Detmer. She seemed a little off still, a little off kilter, but nothing major to talk about. I'm hoping that does turn into something because they really did lay on thick her issues.
I think it's gonna be going a slow on. Burn. It's a slow burn.
Possibly. All right, let's go to a quick break, and then when we get back, we're going to get into the Trill aspects, which is going to be a fun discussion as well. We'll be right back.
Cry havoc! And let's slip the dogs of war!
Everything!
Free stuff is awesome, but free stuff that will spice up your bedroom is even better. Just go to adamandeve.com and select almost any one item for 50% off, and then we'll load on the free stuff. Just enter this very exclusive code, RAINMAN, at checkout, and you'll get 10 tantalizing free gifts, including a sexy item for him, a special toy for her, ooh, and a third item you'll both enjoy.
Ooh.
And 6 extra special bonus items that are sure to rev your engine, pique your curiosity, and even blow you away. Plus,
free shipping!
Always sent in discreet packaging. Go to adamandeve.com now. Get 50% off plus the 10 free gifts when you enter the exclusive offer code RAINMAN. Again, that's RAINMAN. Because without it, no free stuff. That's RAINMAN at adamandeve.com.
Energize.
All right, welcome back, everyone, to Star Trek from the Holodeck, the Discovery Edition. Make sure you find us on iTunes and Stitcher. Just search From the Holodeck. Leave us reviews. Give us thumbs up. Help us get seen by more eyes. Trigger those algorithms. All right, Dave. Let's talk the Trill equation.
I was really excited that they brought this up.
Yeah, I like this element quite a bit.
I do, too.
There does seem to be a lot of thoughts swirling around this concept, a lot of talk within circles, because the actor portrayed is non-binary.
Mm-hmm.
Many members within the queer community were very excited for this episode. And I believe, you know, having the Trill aspect was also a special surprise for many of the queer members within the Trek fandom. that have long gravitated to the Trill species for obvious reasons. I mean, many gay folk and transgenders have gravitated because of what the character has always represented within subtext.
Yeah.
So there was a very delicate nuance when delving into this character, and it's something that we're going to be seeing throughout the entire run of this season with this new addition to the cast and crew of the show. There was an interview that... Let's see here. There's an interview that a couple people, it's from another podcast, I want to say, one of the big giant ones from Sci-Fi Channel, I believe, or Sci-Fi Wire. Is that what they call themselves now?
Sci-Fi Wire, yeah.
They did one with the actor. What's their name? Lou Del Barrio?
Yes. Let me make sure.
So they go into detail. There's a few things I want to share from the interview. Number one, here, the question is, what we learn at the end of People of Earth is that Adira is a human host for a Trill symbiote. Trill have often been held up as this example, often by cisgender people, of trans and non-binary narratives in Star Trek, even though the actors that played them have been cis and the Trill host have presented as cis. Do you think that Discovery is going for an intentional subversion of that exact argument by having it be a statement of something along the lines of, no, this character is a host of a symbiote, but this character themselves is not cis, regardless of the presence of the symbiote? That's fucking confusing as hell.
It is. It is.
And just for people who are not in the know, cis is basically the term for me, an individual who was born with my original gender, right?
Yes.
Is that, in a nutshell, that's what it is?
In a nutshell, that is how it's explained.
Straight people. They identify by the genders they were born as, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And forgive me if I get some of the definitions wrong. I'm an idiot. So her answer to this long-winded question, and I really like her responses. I think it shows a knowledge and an awareness of Star Trek. And also an awareness of her community. She says, yes, exactly what you just said is a perfect way to put it. There is definitely a lot of queer community that have attached itself to the Trill species, but not because the Trill were necessarily like, oh, you know, because they are a host of multiple consciousness, they must be trans. It's that there were sort of like mirrors of experiences. It wasn't like the trans experience, but there are like parts that sort of could speak to some kind of queer narrative. So exactly how you put it is perfect. Adira is non-binary, has always been non-binary before they were a host. It wasn't that having the symbiote brought out something else in them. She says, but I do like how they've brought in the Trill species into Adira's storyline, which kind of validates maybe a lot of what queer Star Trek fans have been in the past.
Yes.
And they're identifying with the Trill in some way. So she understands that perhaps earlier iterations of Trek were walking on eggshells because of the times, that perhaps they didn't go as deep as possibly they should. And maybe even the idea that, hey, you are cis, but then when you put something in you, it changes who you are, and now you identify as that.
Well, remember, I mean, even in the documentary that me and you watched with DS9, Ira always felt that he never went fully into the possibilities that he could have done with Dax.
Right.
He never felt that he could. He never felt that journey that he could have put was right there.
Well, he even alluded to the fact that the network didn't want them to.
Yep.
So they were trying to walk on eggshells and express whatever they could. And she feels Adira understands what they were doing and she respects it because so many others within the community, within the queer community, respect it and love what they did. So she kind of has this idea or this. I feel like she's conveying the sense of, I respect everything that came before, but this is going to be different because I'm not cis, you know, I am non-binary, and now I have a symbiote. So So the character is non-binary. And she says this is going to be an interesting way to craft a story. And the fact that this is all about story, that's why this is great.
Yeah.
It's agenda. It has an agenda to it. Absolutely. You're pushing progressive thought for sure. But I don't give a shit. I don't care if you push progressive thought. I'm all for progressive thought. But you can't just push progressive thought for progressive thought's sake. You need to have a story that makes sense and stays true to the heart of Star Trek. And as long as they do that, I say I'm all for it. I don't give a shit. I don't care what they do.
That's ultimately the thing is, like, I'll be totally honest with you, is like the idea of the idea that they proposed in the Trill in this episode has me very excited for the type of stories that they can delve into.
Exactly. And that's what matters.
I don't care about the agenda behind the stories, the possibilities of the narratives that they can do. That's what has me really excited.
Exactly.
And the fact that Blue does understand the significance really does put my mind at ease that basically they're not simply going to use this as a trope. They're not going to use
a soapbox. Yeah.
It's going to matter. And like, that's why I really do appreciate the fact that at the end of the episode, they made sure to point out that the reason why they want Adrina on the crew is because the Sebonite or the Trill within her has knowledge that will help them find more Federation.
Yeah.
Fantastic. That makes sense to me. That opens up more. And then on top of that, you make that part of the main story without actually standing on a soapbox and say, hey, look at us. Look at us.
Right. It makes for an interesting avenue to take the story while doing exactly what they want, which is pushing and furthering progressive thought, pushing forward the actual plot of the show, which is, I'm sorry, more important than anything else. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what they do with this moving forward. I am fairly excited to see where they take a character who's non-binary as a Trill and how the two experience will coalesce, you know, because yes, Trek writers have used the Trill aspect various times to explore the fluidity of gender. And at times the deconstruction of, I guess you can say, the more traditional sociological concepts of sex and gender. So this is going to be fun.
You know, that's so different.
It is.
It's so different because like, I give a lot of props.
So consistent
with Trill. Yeah.
Right. With the Trill species. I feel like it makes perfect sense.
It really is. This episode is proving to be an example why we as Trek fans have to be not just patient, but comfortable with the creative, the showrunner at this point, who is Michelle Paradise.
I think we need to have I think at this point, we should have confidence, right? And just say, you know what? We can just sit back and yes, not every episode is going to be a 100%er. But I think it's safe to say that Michelle Paradise being included as co-showrunner for last season and predominantly making the decisions this season
is paying dividends.
I think we can say that we can relax a bit and just and enjoy the series and not constantly be ready for
for something bad.
Yeah. And I don't know how I feel about that. I'm not used to that feeling, Dave.
It's so weird.
I'm not used to this feeling. What's happening?
What's happening?
Yeah. Do you think we have time to get into the Trills and their history within Trek? So I mostly want to get into this because of the trolls out there who constantly want to get mad at, you know, the new Trek producers for constantly changing things like the Klingon appearance and the addition. I mean, at this with the Picard thing with the Romulans, the new versions of Romulans they had as well. Was it like three species they had?
Yes.
I mean, listen, this isn't new. Even the Trills, when they were first introduced to Next Generation, had a brow across their forehead, almost like a Bajoran.
Yes.
What happened to that? They just got rid of it. They just, for no reason. I believe during a screen test for Deep Space Nine with the actress that plays Jadzia Dax, they actually had the brow on her. And they said, fuck it. And they gave her tattoos. Those Trill tattoos.
The spots.
Yeah. So Star Trek has always been kind of fucking around with their own continuity and canon at times.
And also, you got to also throw in the fact that while, yes, we're dealing with a Trill, if I'm not correct, Adriana is not full Trill. She's actually human.
Right. That's why she doesn't have spots.
She doesn't have spots. She doesn't have the features that we would associate with a character like, say, Dax.
Right. All right. So a little bit on the Trill canon for folks that may not be in the complete know. All right. So why didn't Burnham and Saru know about Trill? Although Discovery now takes place in 3188-ish, the ship just jumped from the year 2258.
Yes.
This means that in terms of Starfleet knowledge of galactic events, the crew of USS Discovery predates the original series.
Yes.
Okay. That means there's a lot of things they just don't know. They skipped across a lot of time. Mm-hmm. So what does all of this have to do with the Trill? Burnham's dialogue suggests she was aware of Trill, but didn't know about the symbiote thing. This checks with the visual canon we've seen in Discovery so far. Leland and the deleted scenes or bonus scenes of Discovery Season 1 posed as a Trill and a deleted scene from Discovery Season 1. And a Trill crew member appeared in the Disco Era Short Treks episode, The Trouble with Edward.
Yes.
So Starfleet is aware of the Trill. They just were mostly unaware of the fact that the humanoid Trill were often joined with symbiotes. Now, there's also reason for this. If you remember, there's an episode of Deep Space Nine where it's very private. It's a very private and personal thing.
Yes.
So for people not to know about it, I mean, makes perfect sense, especially at this time period predating the original series, which I don't think it has been stated. In fact, I don't even think, is the Trill homeworld even a part of the Federation, even in Deep Space Nine? I don't think they were. I don't think they were, Dave. I could be wrong, and if listeners out there know, please, you know, set me straight.
I think, wait a minute. I do recall, well, no. See, I'm trying to remember. I know for a fact.
But the point is, so we don't weigh ourselves down with continuity. We could be here all day. But the point is that it makes perfect sense that Burnham and Saru wouldn't completely understand the finer details of the Trill species.
Because they're a very secretive species just on their own. I mean, I actually remember in TNG, the Trill were actually brought up with a Riker episode.
Yeah, the host. That's the name of the episode, yeah.
And that was treated like no one knew about the host thing. No one knew about, like, the Trill, about them being, quote-unquote, a parasite.
Right.
So
the canon for the Trill is a little fucky. It's pretty much par for the course, right, when it comes to Star Trek. I mean, you're dealing with 50 years of canon, so things are going to get messed up from time to time.
But that's the thing, is, like, people nowadays, now, when I see trolls actually go after stuff like that, I'm like going, you're just looking for it now. It's obvious that you don't like the series, and you'll try to find anything to hate the series.
Yeah, it's true. All right, Dave, let's go into final thoughts. We only have a few moments here, so why don't you give me your final thoughts in about 30 seconds?
All right, so final thoughts. My grade for this one is a 89.
Oh!
I really like this episode. This episode continues the upward trend for Discovery. As I said, earlier in the show, I do feel that out of the three episodes we've had so far, this one is the best produced and executed.
Well, then how come you're giving it a lower grade?
Because
you forgot what you gave the other ones.
No, not that. It's just as a fan purpose. I loved that second episode, dude. That second episode was fantastic, and I had so much fun with that one. It's hard for me to separate my fanboy from the critic with this one when I have to compare episode 2 to episode 3. Because episode 3, I agree with all the points you made. You know, execution-wise, this was like close to perfection. But, you know, as I said, I fanboyed so hard out of...
episode 2.
I fanboy so hard. Oh, it's all over the place. But, all right. So 89%.
89%. It's still a really strong episode.
All right. So I'm going to give the episode a 91%. I think it was exceptionally done. The writing was fantastic. The year time gap given so that we can justify a different version of Burnham and kind of play around with her characterization is a smart call. We've had 2 years of someone who's wound very tight, who is dealing with a lot of baggage, and what a great scenario to concoct to get rid of a lot of that and give her possibly a new thing she has to work through. So I thought it was an excellent episode. Plus, I mean, Captain Saru, come on.
I know.
So, all right. Well, this does bring us to the end. I want to thank everyone for listening. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
My pain.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain.
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.